Kids Comics.
And here are your hosts, Michael and Andrew Leyland.
Hello, everybody.
Hello, everyone.
And welcome back to Hey Kids Comics 2. There you go. You don't need any bollocks, do you? No. You just go in. That's it. Welcome. I'm Michael Leyland.
And we do this... I'm Andrew Leyland.
Yes. That's the, we did that wrong. I looked at him as I said my name, so I said his name. I'm Andrew Leyland.
And I'm Michael Leyland.
So that was quite funny. Yeah. Do you know, I think people don't care. I think it's like Starsky and Hutch and Buddy and Doyle and all that. They don't give a toss which one we are. I'm Husky. He's Starch. Does that work?
Yeah, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah, that's fine. Anyway, today we're showing that we've got our finger on the pulse, as ever, by covering stuff that relates to a film that came out last month.
Yeah, that's as good as it's going to get.
I mean, as we record this... This is the Fantastic Four's opening weekend, is it not? Yes, it
okay.
is.
Right.
This is the opening weekend. And weirdly, because this doesn't happen anymore because of, you know, life, I have actually seen it.
Right.
I saw it on opening day.
Wow.
8:30 in the morning on the Thursday that it opened.
Ah, school holidays.
Yes. Nothing to do with a keen-ass fan. Yeah. Nothing to do with wanting to see it before any old idiot on the internet could spoil it.
Yeah.
It was purely... I drop your mum off at work at 8 o'clock. That's on at 8:30. I could just go and watch it.
Yeah.
I'm not at work. And I came reading all that about it. So I thought, bye, heck.
I went to see them Fantastic Four.
I bought some black pudding.
And I came out and I was in bloody Yorkshire.
I went Greg's and I bought myself a sausage roll.
I had a bloody pie bomb, I did.
I did, I had a pie bomb. And then I watched that reek good Fantastic Four film.
And it were reek good, it were.
Although it does beef up Sue Storm's part. So all right. The people who want Sue... Oh, what does it all mean, Reed? Yeah. They're going to be disappointed.
With her secret power, her feminine intuition.
Her feminine intuition, which Stanley did think was a secret power. But no, in all seriousness, I really enjoyed it. Okay. I don't know what you're going to think of it.
I mean, I've not seen it.
It is a straightforward... Spoilers, slight for superhero movies, Superman and the Fantastic Four. Only slight, because Michael hasn't seen any of them, so it's not going to be much of a conversation.
Life.
Yeah, the aforementioned life and how to live it. It's pretty much... They both have a lot in common, Superman and Fantastic Four. They're both reasonably optimistic.
Okay.
They both have similar themes in their stories, one of which being, what does Earth's mightiest hero do when he comes upon, or they come upon, a threat that even they can't punch,
okay,
basically. There is an undercurrent subplot of what will you do for your child, which, again, he's in both films, which is strange. Both of them are quite colourful. You've mocked the ability to light a film nowadays.
Yeah, we just forgotten how to light films.
But in FF, it suits it.
Okay.
Because it's got that whole retro 60s futurism aesthetic.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Now, some people have said that there is a cover of a Time magazine in the film that clearly says it's 1964.
Right.
I did not see that.
Okay.
So I don't know whether the 60s just stayed the 60s because of the Fantastic Four's advancement. But there's some lovely little things in it, like they record stuff onto vinyl.
Okay.
Which was lovely. I thought that was a nice little touch. The design of the Fantastic Car is brilliant.
Right.
And who'd have thought, and I know... that this is going to blow your mind.
I'm ready.
The thumbnail on the YouTube is your face going, when I say this, but right. You know, for the longest time,
yeah,
and I'm not blowing my own horn here, but I am.
I should hope not. Well, in front of me as well.
I've got that vertebra that prevents me from actually being able to do that. But, right, I was saying, why can't we just do Superman?
Yeah.
The smartest producer to have worked on modern day Star Trek was the guy, when they were prepping Strange New Worlds, well, how do we do this one? What do we do with this one? He said, why don't we just make Star Trek? Why don't we say, like, Gene Roddenberry's still alive.
Yeah.
He's making the original Star Trek today with today's technology. Go and do it. Go and make that show. And that's what they've done. And tell surprise, it's the best Star Trek since Deep Space Nine went off the air. And even though, the dirty secret about Deep Space Nine, right?
Okay.
When it's a five-star show, it's a five-star show.
Yeah, yeah.
Unfortunately, it's 26 episodes a season, and half of that is boring as sin.
Yeah.
So it's arguably the best Star Trek since The Next Generation.
As boring as DS9 got. It was never Voyager
well,
boring.
Well, see, there's the thing, right?
Right.
What is more... I'm sorry we've become a Star Trek podcast ever so slightly for a second.
This is the secret third Star Trek show that we never got around to doing.
We will loop back to Superman and the Fantastic Four, I promise. Here's the thing, right?
Yeah.
Is it better to be a five-star show, but half of it's crap? But when it's good, it's very, very, very good. Or is it better to be relentlessly mediocre for seven seasons?
See, you want the highs and the lows, don't you?
There isn't any in Voyager. It is resolutely a three-star show from beginning to end.
Because without the 22-24 episode highs and lows, is you've got what we've got now when it's 5 years to make eight episodes of an hour feature length. It's like, no, just give me... Just give me some low-budget naff bits for a little bit.
Well, the thing is, this week's Strange New Worlds episode is the third episode of Season 3, so you know where we are, right? And it amazes me, they've got all the money in the world, and yet the planet set still looks like a set. Because they didn't go on location for this one.
Yeah.
And it still looks like a bunch of plastic leaves. Even with all the money, it still looks like planet hell.
That's how our Gene would have done it.
That's how Gene, exactly right. I loved it. I thought, brilliant. Love it. I want more plastic rocks.
Yeah.
And
fake plastic trees.
So I want more of that. But the Fantastic Four embraces that 60s aesthetic.
Okay.
And it's not in any way linked to the other MCU movies.
Mm-hmm.
So at no point is your nerdy brain going, well, this must fit in between scene 7 and 8 of Black Widow. But that has to be after Thunderbolts. There's none of that.
But the intent, that is the intention, especially based on the end of the Thunderbolts.
I haven't seen Thunderbolts.
Okay, so the end of the Thunderbolts is a teaser for the Fantastic Four.
Right.
So you know where it's going.
Right.
So already
it. I'm not going to say why, but the end credit scene ruins it.
Okay.
I don't want that scene. I don't want it. I don't care about it. I don't need it. It's very definitely canon.
Right.
Sadly. The very end credit scene that you stay 10 minutes worth of credits for is another one of those cute ones that's completely unnecessary, but you can't help but leave the theatre smiling.
Okay.
You know, like when Captain America's, that you've sat through the end credits. That one.
Okay.
It's one of them.
Right.
So I loved it. A lot of people have said, why is it worth going? Why is it worth bothering with?
It's not.
It isn't. If you're brasting for a pee, I would say don't bother waiting. And just watch it on YouTube or whatever.
Yeah.
But if you want...
it'll be on Disney Plus in a month.
Yeah, well, I'm hoping that when this comes out, we'll be able to tie in with its release on Disney Plus. So Superman and the Fantastic Four, I think Superman is a better film.
Mm.
I think it's better made. I think there's more thought being put into the actual mechanics of the plot. Have you seen what everyone's kicking off about?
No.
So, all right, I won't say anything
unless
you've seen it.
Maybe. I don't know.
Well, I can't say without saying.
Okay.
So I won't say.
Right.
All right. But the thing that everyone's kicking about,
right,
when we did our Superman show,
okay,
you actually pointed out in Man of Steel that Lara says, so he will conquer them?
Right. Okay.
And you were like, okay, right, all right. And lots of people are kicking off.
I think I might have seen this because obviously as soon as...
Oh, spoilers for Superman. But yeah, there are certain people in the world
that thinks that when they have seen the film, everyone else has seen the film.
Yes.
So it's okay to just post screenshots. And
I have discussed this. They don't care about anyone else.
And so I feel like I have seen Superman without having seen Superman.
Right.
So I know about that character. I know about this thing. And it's like,
see,
I'm in no rush to see it now.
I didn't see Superman until the Monday morning that it had been out. Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
Yeah.
Because of life, which we've just talked about. So I just didn't go on the internet.
Mm.
It was turned off, didn't bother. Muted the word Superman, whatever.
Yeah.
And so I saw it pretty much unhindered by spoilers.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't seen anything. And I thought, I don't know whether... I'll be honest with you. Neither one of them goes anywhere you don't think it's going to go.
Yeah.
It's hard to say there are spoilers for a plot that you can pretty much time the beats.
And
which doesn't make it not good.
I assume as well that the Fantastic Four movie is just Fantastic Four 48 to 50.
Nope.
Okay.
No, it's that basic plot.
Yeah.
But there are differences because it isn't a straight adaptation of what we laughingly refer to as the Galactus Trilogy, which is in no way a trilogy.
No, it's not. It's not.
So they've taken that basic idea, but Rise of the Silver Surfer took that basic idea as well.
Yeah.
And did the same thing with it. And there's a reason that Rise of the Silver Surfer was the better one of the two.
It's a low bar.
Well, yeah, exactly. This one is better than all the previous four Fantastic Four movies combined.
There's four?
Yeah. if we count the Roger Corman one that we all pretend we've never seen, that was never released.
But we've all seen it, and it pops on YouTube occasionally before it's taken down for copyright reasons, and it's probably on archive.org if you search hard enough for it somewhere. It's out there, easily viewed. They've sold it as bootlegs at conventions for years.
If you do that, you can watch it. It don't suck.
Okay.
It's not awful for a low-budget movie from 1993 or whatever it was that looks like a telly movie. And the people they cast are all fine.
Right.
Nothing wrong with the cast. There's a long, boring bit in the middle with the mole man that you just don't need. Cut that out. But it don't suck.
Okay.
And everyone who is interested in the FF in any way whatsoever has seen it.
Right.
They did a terrible job of banning it.
Why was it banned?
It was allegedly.
Get a little blue, did it?
No, it was allegedly made so that they could keep the copyright on the characters.
Okay.
And there's two different stories. There was never any intention to release it, mm-hmm. which I think is bollocks. You wouldn't go to the effort of making a film with no intention of releasing it.
Yeah.
Or the other story is afterwards, Avi Arad did everything in his power to stop it from being released. I tend to believe the second story more than the first story.
Right.
Because, like I say, why would you make something, spend that money? The little amount of money as it was, but still, with a view to not releasing it. But you know what's really cute?
And again, minor spoilers for the Fantastic Four, but again, this is all in the first 10 minutes.
The four people who played the Fantastic Four in that Roger Corman movie that we all pretend we've never seen are in the new one.
Right, okay.
Which is, I thought that was quite a nice, we're sorry you got screwed over. Come and be in the new one.
Yeah.
Oh, that was lovely. Because Marvel don't have to do that stuff. And I thought that was quite sweet. So the film, Dana loved it.
Yeah, I mean, she just likes the Fantastic Four anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, personally, it's a weird one. Because it's directed by the same guy who directs Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm. And Game of Thrones.
Which is insane to me. But I feel like the more that I saw of it, trailer-wise, the less interesting it looked.
Well, it's funny you should say that. Okay. Because, one, the aesthetic is beautiful.
Right.
So it's worth watching just for that. It's worth watching for being the first Marvel movie since probably... What, Captain America?
To actually be a film.
To actually be a film. That you don't have to have seen any other film in the Marvel Universe, and there are now 37 of these things.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's you can just go to this one.
Yeah.
And like Superman, it eschews the origin. Mm-hmm. You get a brief... Mark Gatiss is in it.
Yeah, he narrates the trailer.
Yeah, and he narrates the origin.
Right.
Because it opens with, spoilers for Fantastic Four. So this is only the first 10 minutes. It opens with a celebration of it's been 4 years since they came into our lives, mm-hmm. and Reed's inventions have made the world a much nicer place, and the FF are out there saving the world on a daily basis, and we love them all, mm-hmm. and Sue Richards runs the Future Foundation, and she's made the world a lovely place.
Okay.
With her diplomatic skills and all that stuff. All that's lovely. But Mark Gatiss is there, and... This isn't going to bother American audiences in the same way Hugh Dennis, being in the beginning of No Time to Die, made me go, but why is he not making jokes?
Yeah.
And it's the same as Mark Gatiss comes on, I'm going like, but why is he not trying to arrest Sherlock? Or why is he not, in Royston Vasey? What's going on? So it's one of those things that the vast majority of the people who see this film will not know Mark Gatiss.
But for me,
it was like, you'll never leave. He was very... I didn't burn him. You did well, Tubbs. There was all of that just going through my head. You're my wife now.
I get you, yeah.
So anyway, but it's great. And it's lovely that this one is a Kirby film. It's a Jack Kirby film.
Right.
It's not a Stan Lee one. It's a Jack Kirby one. It's on Earth 828. 28th of the 8th was Jack Kirby's birthday.
Okay.
So that's nice.
Okay.
And there's a lovely little quote from Jack Kirby at the very... That's worth staying through the end credits for.
Well, it made me laugh yesterday because Dana came out of it going, she heard some people say, who's Jack Kirby? And so, you're going to get it.
She texted me that and I said, but that's good.
Yeah.
Because it now knows these people know his name.
Yeah. And also, it's you got to start somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah, you've got to... Because let's be honest, we're not standard nothing.
Mm.
We're not anti-Stan in any way, but it was his name that everybody knew.
Yeah.
And as much as he may have give credit to his writers' introductions to the masterworks and stuff, that's a very small part of the audience compared to how many people saw an Avengers film.
Yeah, Stan Lee's a household name.
Yeah.
Jack Kirby's not.
Yeah, and so if these people are coming out going, who was Jack Kirby? Good. That means they now know his name.
Yeah.
So overall, I think Superman was the better film, but Fantastic Four gave me a big goofy grin on my face. because, and I also think there was the expectation level, wasn't there? Both of them are at the third strike and you're out in many ways. Superman's had Superman Returns, swing and a miss. The Zack Snyder movie, swing and a miss. So this is his third time at bat. If this had failed,
yeah,
you're not getting another Superman movie. See, but bigger than that, you're not getting the DC film universe.
A lot of people have forgotten about Superman Returns Good. Already. And then Snyder's still the big one. He's still the big cloud looming over it, isn't he?
Yeah, but he'll go away now. And then same with the Fantastic Four. You've got the one we pretend we've never seen, so that doesn't really count.
Yeah.
You've got the Tim Story films, and even though that got a sequel, swing and a miss, let's be honest.
That's the one that I feel like we all tell ourselves was good, even though it wasn't.
Yeah,
like,
because it's that thing we've talked about. It's not awful. It's Trainspotting.
Yeah.
Isn't it? It's that thing in Trainspotting. Well, that's no bad. Yeah, but it's not good, is it?
It's this thing, and I've never seen it, I just know that it exists. The ending of Deadpool and Wolverine is this love letter tribute to all the 20th Century Fox films, and loads of people my age were going, oh, how I miss it. No, let's not pretend it. They were not good. Let's not pretend they were.
Even
just
your
because,
beloved X-Men.
Let's not pretend that they were good just because we're older now and, oh, we want to go back. No, they weren't good.
And now you want to be a tourist in your own youth.
Yeah, so, like, let's leave them behind. The 20th Century Fox ones were not good. Me and Dana have rewatched all of them. They're not good. Mm. Let's leave them in the past.
But even Daredevil?
Don't even.
So this was its third strike at bat, like Superman. And if they'd missed with this one, I think Marvel would have been in real trouble. Because, let's be honest, nothing else they've done has caught fire the way it did leading up to Avengers, Infinity War and Endgame. That run of movies where even something like Captain Marvel's making $1 billion.
Yeah.
And let's be honest, I liked Captain Marvel, don't get me wrong, I'm not a Brie Larson hater. But that film's not $1 billion movie, is it? That to me is like Aquaman. Although Captain Marvel's a much better film.
None of them are $1 billion movies.
No, Aquaman made $1 billion. How?
I don't know. There's obligation there, isn't there? There's like a sense of commitment.
Yeah. And that's gone. That's gone away. So you've had a string of movies where Thunderbolts was commercially well received but made no money. Some people are even arguing it lost money.
Mm.
Black Widow was released straight to streaming, which annoyed ScarJo no end.
Yeah.
And other than Guardians 3 and Spider-Man, they've not had any that people have gone out to the cinema and watched. And what's the key, though? Spider-Man was wrapping up plots from Endgame.
Yeah.
Guardians was the third part of the Guardians trilogy.
Yeah.
None of the new ones have really caught fire. So if Fantastic Four hadn't worked, which I think they're going to be the new linchpin, then they were in trouble. I honestly think that. And I think it's interesting that the two movies where they have embraced the comics aesthetic more than anything else of recent years, neither one of them's deconstructionist.
Mm-hmm.
Neither one of them's miserable. Neither one of them's like, what would it be if this was the real world? Both of them actively embrace that this is not the real world.
Yeah.
And it's the much better movies for it, for living in their own little world. Well, yeah, you can still pick at humanity, but people just are nicer. And I think it's telling that they've just made a Superman film. And they've just made a Fantastic Four film. Just like they just made Star Trek. They didn't try to deconstruct it. They've not tried to reinvent it or make it miserable. Or what would this be like in the real world?
Mm-hmm.
Superheroes would be laughed off screen in the real world. That's the gospel truth. We wouldn't trust them at all. So Snyder got that right, I guess. So by not setting them in the real world works in their favour. I think you like Superman. I'm not sure you Fantastic Four will. I mean, you'll probably be like, yeah, it's fine.
Okay.
To be honest with you. But I'd go and see Superman because I do think it's a better movie. But Fantastic Four gave me the big goofy grin. Because we're covering the Fantastic Four today, but should we do an email?
Yeah.
Okay, so the only email we have this week is Michael Bailey. No one sends emails anymore. Should we ditch this? I don't know. I quite like emails.
I do, but there's none.
I know. Well, there is this week.
How do we do an email segment with no emails?
Well, we just wouldn't do it. And we wouldn't mention it to draw attention to it.
Yeah.
So, you know. But do people have thingios? Everyone does Facebook and Twitter. And
I think we should bring back forums and message boards.
I think we should bring back forums because that fits in what we're talking about this week.
Hey,
I like that. Gentlemen, says Michael Bailey. So it was weird listening to y'all talk about the first issue of Man of Steel because my feelings on Byrne's Superman have changed a lot over the last few years. I used to hold it as the gold standard and now it's a version of the origin and not the origin. And in all honesty, not even the best of the origins. It forms the foundation of my era, but there are bits and bobs that I just don't care for. Well, we were the same. I mean, artistically, it was still unsurpassed. But there were bits like Lara going, so you'll conquer them? And you're like, Jesus, love, are you Zod's mum? So there are parts of your conversation that I disagreed with that surprised me because I thought it would be a lockstep with y'all. But there were small things, and ultimately it came down to this was all expanded on in later in the various World of miniseries. Which doesn't matter one bit when you're looking at this series. How did Clark earn a living in Metropolis? Well, he worked at a diner while going to college. Again, not in Man of Steel. Why did Krypton explode? A terrorist organisation called Black Zero detonated a device that eventually led to the chain reaction that not only caused the Green Death, but Doctor Who wasn't involved this time, so it didn't get stopped, but the planet's destruction. Again, not in, as Mike mentions, not in Man of Steel. All 4 points, and to quote the final issue, ultimately meaningless. Fair enough. Fun conversation. Well done. Top marks. Until next time, Mikey might be. Well, thank you very much, Michael. We're glad you emailed in, because without you, there wouldn't have been an email section. And the world would have been much better off. No, I said that wrong. And the world...
No, you didn't.
and the world would have been much poorer for this show not having an email section, wouldn't it? Anyway, what can you say about the Fantastic Four?
I'd imagine enough to fill an episode.
Enough to fill a 90-minute episode of Young Kids Comics. The progenitors of the Marvel Age of Comics, Imaginauts. Stars of the world's greatest comic magazine, they kicked off the Age of Marvels. Created in 1961 by Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, they took the comics reading world by Johnny Storm. Yes, we've heard all the reasons before. They argued, they bickered, they were ugly, they didn't even wear costumes. But the main one is by not being a superhero book. Because the Fantastic Four aren't a superhero team. They're family. They're Edgar Rice Burroughs meets Little Women. Swiss Family Robinson meets the Forsyth Saga. Reed Richards, the stretchy, super smart one whose mind goes in a thousand directions at once. Susan Storm Richards, his wife, the invisible one, and the one who holds them all together. Johnny Storm, Sue's younger brother, the hot-headed one, quite literally. And Ben Grimm, the grumpy one. Over the years, additions have been made to the family, and the better ones have added to the family feel. Reed and Sue have two kids, Franklin and Valeria. Ben's girlfriend, artist Alicia Masters, is now his wife. And the additions of these, plus more, make the four even more of a family book. Lots have been written about the found family in recent years, but the FF are an actual family, with all the love and angst that that brings with it. What's your history with the FF?
Very little.
Yeah, weird that.
I never cared for the Fantastic Four. I remember when you got the omnibuses were coming out.
The very first omnibus was Fantastic Four, wasn't it?
And I read it, and I thought, this is fine. I never really dug it as much because I think, I probably mentioned before, that the FF solidified my idea that I don't like Jack Kirby. But then...
But you've grown up and changed that opinion.
As Kirby's art evolved through Fantastic Four, he was going from the monster guy to the superhero guy, and you see that through that Fantastic Four run, those first 50 or so issues. That's when he becomes Jack Kirby. I didn't see that Jack Kirby until I was reading New Gods. My Jack Kirby was the muddy guy from those first few issues.
Mm. And let's be brutally honest, those first 12 or so issues are very rough.
Yeah.
When you go back and read them nowadays. They're the nascent elements of the Marvel Universe are all there, but it's not even as polished as Spider-Man would be.
Yeah.
Just a year or so later.
But yeah, I read it. It was fine. I've read Fantastic Four stuff since. There's just never been that thing that kind of grabs me about them. I think the last Fantastic Four I read that I enjoyed was the Hickman Future Foundation stuff. Because that felt like... Do you know there was that argument about Grant Morrison doing Superman where you see a lot of Superman where he's just fighting other kind of like superheroes and that, and Morrison brought across this idea that maybe Superman should be doing more cosmic stuff and that kind of thing. And other writers have done that kind of thing before. Hickman did that with the Fantastic Four for me. It's like they're suddenly doing these much bigger mind-bending adventures, and that just kind of clicked for me in a way that they hadn't before or had since then. So yeah, it's just nothing... Not really much about them really grabbed my interest over the years.
See, my memory is vivid. Your dad, Grandad Peter, had all the Mighty World of Marvel comics. Mm-hmm. Had the early stuff in. But they clicked for me when, in the very early 80s, like 1980, 1981, Marvel UK launched pocketbooks, Marvel mm-hmm. pocketbooks. Mm-hmm. These are like the American ones. These were flimsy,
yeah.
black and white, printed on toilet paper. The usual Marvel UK cheap.
Yeah.
Get it, churn it out, get it out, the bollocks. They were 15 pence each.
Wow.
But there were 48 pages with two complete stories in, plus covers and adverts and whatever.
Yeah.
The Spider-Man one, after it published a couple of issues like giant-sized Spider-Man, that were relatively new at the time, they went back to the beginning and started doing the Lee Ditko stuff.
Okay.
And the Fantastic Four one started with Fantastic Four, like, 50, I think.
Right.
It didn't go all the way back to the beginning.
Okay.
Or it started with The Marriage of Reed and Sue, I want to say.
Mm.
So it started at peak Kirby.
Yeah.
So you didn't have to wade through him becoming...
It was already there.
Yeah. Issue 9, I want to say, was a double-sized issue, so it cost 30p.
Mm-hmm.
But it was about 5 issues. It was 100 pages.
Okay.
And in that volume, they had what I'm going to recommend as one of the stories later on. Issues 59 and 60, the Doctor Doom learns of Galactus. Well, he's already, because Galactus, he will have seen it. But he learns of the Power Cosmic.
Mm-hmm.
And he learns that the Power Cosmic is transferred to people. And he hatches this plot to lure the Silver Surfer in,
yeah.
befriend him, and then betray him.
Okay.
And steal the Power Cosmic from him.
Yeah.
And Doctor Doom gets the Power Cosmic.
Okay.
And that was my awakening.
Yeah.
That was my, this is epic. Because that was such a good idea, building on what had happened previously, to tell a brand new story with it. Because, of course, Doctor Doom would want the Power Cosmic.
Yeah.
Doctor Doom wants all the power.
Mm-hmm.
He's greedy like that.
And he's everywhere now.
Yeah.
He's so greedy, he's in every title at the moment.
He's being paid $80 million to reappear in Marvel movies, even though, you know, you can decide whether or not he's worth it. But anyway, that was my awakening with the Fantastic Four. So that was around 80, 81. I don't think it's coincidence John Byrne came on the book in 1981 and did it from 81 to 86. He did 232, issue 232 to 293. And that made me a Fantastic Four fan as well as a John Byrne fan.
Okay.
Because it felt like he was building on that cosmic idea. And very quickly you get into the negative zone of it all and Annihilus and all of that stuff. And all that stuff making the FF big and cosmic and exciting.
Yeah.
Rather than patrolling the streets of New York and punching out muggers.
Yeah.
Which they don't really do. That's what made it more interesting for me. So I was in from that point. And yeah, there's been ebbs and flows over the years. The thing with the Fantastic Four, like a lot of Marvel and DC comics, is if you go back to the beginning and read all of it, it gets a tad tedious.
Yeah.
Because there are certain tropes that will just keep coming back. The team will break up. Mm-hmm. They'll get back together. Ben will be cured. And then he won't be. And then some members of the team will leave and be replaced by pseudo members for a bit.
Yeah.
In some cases, having a barely recognisable Fantastic Four team. Walt Simonson, J. Michael Straczynski, Steve Englehart, we're looking at you. And the Reed and Sue will go through bad patches in their marriage and she'll run off to Namor or whatever. Lather, rinse, repeat. So the best thing you can do with the Fantastic Four, really, is do a selected read through. Now, I know that will affect the... that some people who have to do everything. It's not ADHD, is it? What's it called? When you have to do everything. You have to see everything. You have to read everything. There's a reason for it. I get that. I understand that. But for people who just want to dip their toes in, pick up the Penguin Books Fantastic Four volume that is currently still available.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what the hardcover is, but the paperback is still in bookshop.
Yeah.
And that has got in it issues 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 10, 11, 48, 49, 50, 51, and Fantastic Four Annual 6. If you've seen the film, this gives you a hankering for more of that kind of thing. This is the book, because this has got, as we've mentioned, the inaccurately named Galactus trilogy.
Yeah.
But Annual 6 is The Birth of Franklin.
Okay.
So that's a good one to get. I'd also recommend trying to find Annual 1 and 2,
mm-hmm.
because I think it's Annual 2 that has this absolutely fantastic Doctor Doom story. And that was another one where they weren't afraid to mess around with it. The FF don't appear in that at all.
Right.
It is a Doctor Doom story. And it's great. It's absolutely brilliant. After that, the John Byrne run that we just mentioned. After that, the Mark Waid, Mike Waringo run,
mm-hmm.
issue 60 through issue 524. Now, I know what you're thinking. Blimey, that's a long run. No, 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 it isn't. Marvel had this annoying thing of restarting their comics with a new number one, returning to the original number in this case, issue 500. But this is all in an omnibus.
Yeah.
Just going by the omnibus, all the Ultimate Collections, that's much easier. Michael has mentioned Jonathan Hickman's run from 2009 to 2012. Somewhat influential on the film.
Yeah.
I think it leans more into the Kirby of it all.
And then... Hickman as well jumped over. Hickman built on the back of Hitch and Mark Miller, didn't he?
Yeah, but that run's awful.
Is it?
Yes.
I remember, I mean, I read it as it was coming out. I remember enjoying it, but I could have been enjoying it for Brian Hitch.
Yeah, but Brian Hitch doesn't finish it.
Of course.
Mark Miller doesn't finish it.
Of course.
So he just peters out.
Of course.
It's dreadful. Right. Overall, I think even Hitch has said it's one of the most unsatisfying things he's ever worked on. Because right. He really wanted to do the Fantastic Four.
Yeah.
And then it just petered out.
Right.
Now, whether that was him or Mark Miller or other factors, I don't know. Ultimately, for me, the fact that Mark Miller writes it is the down thing, not Hitch. I love Hitch. And I wish he'd got a proper Fantastic Four. But yeah, he spun that off into another Fantastic Four comic. So Hickman made the Fantastic Four popular enough to have two comics,
mm-hmm.
which hadn't happened since The Thing had his own book in the 70s and 80s with Marvel 2-in-1. But they're available, I think it's a 2-volume omnibus set.
I think so, yeah.
Or about 3 or 4 complete collections.
Yeah.
Just buy them. Or go straight to the Ryan North Modern Run, which started in 2022, has been the best the book's been in years.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely non-stop. They've just relaunched it with a new number one. Can't imagine why. But that first run they did, where he scored, right, every issue would be about a member of the team.
Okay.
So... Yeah. Johnny Storm in, and this issue would focus on Johnny.
Yeah.
Even though the rest of the team were in it, he was the focus on it. But then he'd go in weird angle. Alicia Masters in, and it's a story where Alicia and the Thing are off on holiday together, but Alicia is the focus of the story.
Right.
And then he'd mix and match. He'd put Reed and Alicia together for a story,
okay,
which you've never seen before. He puts Johnny and Valeria together for a story.
Right.
And that kind of mixing and matching the team really worked. The only problem I have with it is the art is inconsistent. Because he's not had a regular artist.
Okay, right.
So the art has been inconsistent, but the writing has been so good you've kind of glossed over it. One of the reasons for the new number one, other than the new cynical film,
mm-hmm.
is that they've given him a permanent artist, which I think is Humberto Ramos.
Oh, is he carrying over?
He's never done the others.
Right.
Humberto Ramos does not draw on any of the others.
No, I mean the same writer, is he carrying over?
North's carrying on, because critically, this has been the best received FF run in years.
Okay.
I don't know if the sales figures are any good.
Yeah.
But so they're giving him a regular artist, which can only help.
But, recently started as well, I think, to tie into the movie. There's a miniseries, an anthology miniseries, Fantastic Four Fanfare.
Yes.
The love letter, I guess, to Marvel Fanfare.
Yeah.
It's fun.
I've read the first issue of that, and it is.
The first issue of that being the one where Johnny's trying to wind up the Thing.
Yes.
But then the Thing flips the tables.
Yeah.
And then the one where Johnny's on Love Island.
would fit perfectly in the film.
Yeah.
Last time we talked about Superman having a crossover with Love Island.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Marvel missed a trick there, because Johnny on Love Island works.
Yeah.
Would totally work. Because he just... The thing with the film version, well, he's still got that cocky Chris Evans vibe,
mm-hmm.
but he's not a prick.
Right, okay.
In the new one.
Yeah.
He earns his place in the team. So he's still Johnny.
Yeah.
But he's not... as assholic as Johnny. Because let's be honest, Chris Evans can play a prick exceptionally well.
Yeah.
Because he's got that jock American football obnoxiousness to him.
Mm.
Just him. I'm sure he's a lovely man, Chris Evans, by all accounts he is. But he's got that vibe.
Yes.
So he can play pricks incredibly well.
Yes.
Yeah. And he brought that to Johnny, which I didn't like. Also, he's too old.
Yeah.
When he did Fantastic Four.
I mean, the current actor's also quite old.
Yeah, but he doesn't look it.
Okay.
He looks...
The power of bleach.
Yeah. Well, you would know that. he looks like you.
Right.
He looks in his early to mid-20s.
Okay.
And Sue looks in her late 20s to early 30s, which works.
Yeah.
So he's still young enough to be able to get away with being slightly cocky.
Mm.
I don't know how old the actor really is, but he looks around 24.
Yeah.
He did. So it works really well. Oh, also as well, I'm going to mention this. As a primer to the film, Marvel released Fantastic Four First Steps, which I have here, a comic that uses the brilliant conceit of, in Marvel comics, we've seen that Marvel published Fantastic Four comics.
Yeah.
in the Fantastic Four comic.
Yes.
And the Fantastic Four have to vet the stories and approve the stories
mm-hmm.
and tell them what happened. They're supposed to be a real-life chronicle.
Yeah.
And there's been funny issues where they've had to make a story up.
Okay.
Because the Fantastic Four were in the negative zone. And Ben hates that.
Yeah.
Ben hates when they make stories up. And there's a John Byrne issue where he goes to the Marvel office and says, "What's this crap? This didn't happen."
Right.
And John Byrne's like, "Yeah, but the real story was boring." And Ben's like, "Boring?" And that was a really good story. So, but this comic is mm-hmm. that, but for the film.
Right.
So this is what you would have bought if you were a character in the movie.
Yeah.
And it gives you the background on who the FF are. And the, but there's beautiful
adverts
mock 60s adverts for the Fantastica. And an interview with Reed Richards. Johnny Storm's fan club. Johnny talks from his heart. The things to know if you wish to date him. All this stuff. Absolutely great. Brilliant. And that
mm-hmm.
made me want to see the film more than any of their marketing.
Okay.
Because I really enjoyed it. And I got a free badge.
Always a plus.
Always, I got a free badge when I went to the cinema. There's also The Coming of Galactus by James Lovegrove. As you can see, I'm literally halfway through it. It is an adaptation of what we laughingly call the Galactus trilogy into novel form. Sue's part gets beefed up a lot. So the, what does it all mean, Reed fans won't like it. But other than that, it expands the story. Much more realistic sounding science.
Mm-hmm.
Don't know if it is, but it sounds it and it fleshes it out. Lovegrove wrote the better Firefly novels, as well as a Sherlock Holmes novel or two. So the book just breezes on. I started it the other day and I'm already halfway through it. So I don't expect it'll be long before I finish it. But that's really good. But today, Michael and I are covering Fantastic Four Antithesis by Mark Waid and Neil Adams. This Man, This Monster from FF51 by Stanley and Jack Kirby. And Full Circle by Alex Ross. You've read all of these, I presume?
I have read all of these, yes.
Good. So, first off, should we have a look at Fantastic Four Antithesis, which was originally a four-issue miniseries collected in this not quite Treasury edition that Marvel seem to be fond of?
Yeah, it's...
What would you say that is? It's not a Treasury, is it?
It's like a tabloid book.
Yeah. Because it's bigger than a Treasury edition.
But it has the actual... It has covers.
Yeah.
Which a Treasury... I mean, a Treasury does have a cover, but this is a, like, this is a proper book cover.
Yeah. It's weird, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's they did Captain America's Bicentennial Battles reprinted like this.
Mm-hmm.
The history of the Marvel Universe is like this. I don't know what it is.
It's a nice collection, but it's not a Treasury. It's just an oversized paperback.
Yeah, but it's that size.
Yeah.
So it really suits Neil Adams' work. But anyway, it seems to have slipped under the radar of lots of people, as loads of people aren't aware this exists.
Mm.
It's really weird. Despite being one of the creators of one of the definitive runs on the series,
yeah,
Mark Waid, and drawn by Neil feckin' Adams.
Yeah.
It's weird. Adams passed away in 2022, was a comics industry legend. He was the artist who reinvented Batman after the camp excesses of the TV show. He didn't do really a lot for Marvel, did he? When you look on Maximizing World, there's 9 issues of X-Men.
One of which is collected in this.
One of which is collected in this from 1969. He did a couple of Thor stories
yeah.
in 1970. Smattering of other things, a Conan here and a couple of Avengers there, before really finding his own in other places.
Yeah, I mean, I was quite surprised because I didn't really know he did any Marvel. So
yeah.
when we saw that he'd done this.
Yeah, because all of his Marvel work was very much before your time, wasn't it?
Mm.
So... And none of his Marvel work was really something that was on my radar.
Yeah.
I wasn't that big an X-Men fan, so I didn't have those X-Men comics, so you didn't read them as a kid.
Yeah.
Same with Thor. I'd read Conan, but I didn't... It's weird with Conan, isn't it? I didn't get into Conan until I was an adult.
Right.
And Dark Horse started reprinting it.
Yeah.
But you associate John Buscema more with Conan.
I mean, like Adams works, I guess. He fits.
Oh,
he
Adams does great Conan.
Yeah.
He does brilliant Conan. And it's one of those things that if you could have given him a long run on something at Marvel,
yeah.
it would have been Conan.
Yeah.
But, you know, this was inked by Mark Farmer. The basic synopsis, again, we don't spend a lot of time with synopsis anymore, because if you're going to read the book, you're going to read the book, aren't you? Spoilers, obviously. The Fantastic Four face off against Antithesis, a being from the Negative Zone who rips the power from Galactus and nearly kills the Silver Surfer. He's headed towards Earth with an army of beings all perverted by his powers to spread corruption through the galaxy. The FF are imbued with the power cosmic to aid the Surfer in preventing this destructive force and to free the galaxy. But to do that, Reed takes the power of Galactus into himself. Galen, the humanoid form from which Galactus became, doesn't really want to be Galactus again, and Reed is willing to die to allow the threat of Galactus to be destroyed forever. The Fantastic Three and the Silver Surfer must team up with Agatha Harkness to mix magic with science to free Reed and restore balance to the Force. That's not a bad synopsis, is it?
No.
But yeah. All things considered. Despite my belief that people are largely unaware of this, it was originally a miniseries that had 5 variant covers for issue 1.
Of course.
It went to a second print.
Yeah.
So issue 2 had 6 covers, issue 3 had 4 covers, and issue 4 had a pitiful 2 covers. So they're not even trying by the end. Let's be brutally honest. What did you think of this?
As a whole?
Yes.
I got why not a lot of people have heard of it.
Why?
And it's one of those weird things where you've got one of the biggest names in Fantastic Four history.
Yeah.
And you've got one of the biggest names in comics history.
Yeah.
And what I think it boiled down to was I read this all in one sitting.
Yeah, I did.
I quite enjoyed it. Thought it was quite breezy summer blockbuster.
Mm-hmm.
It's perfectly middle-of-the-road mediocre from Wade. And really good for his age, but obviously, for obvious reasons, not great Neil Adams. It's just perfectly fine, perfectly serviceable. The art's really good, but not what you expect from Neil Adams, because he's obviously really old at this point. And by the time I got to the end of it, I was like, that was fine, and I never thought of it again.
See,
until now.
Until when you've had two now. See, I 50% agree with that.
Mm.
I agree with it's middle of the road Wade, but middle of the road Wade is still great. This is still an entertaining story. It's still a fun story.
Yeah.
I am not going to hold this up as being the best that Mark Waid has ever done. I don't think it's his best Fantastic Four stuff.
Mm.
But I still think, like you said, for a 4-issue miniseries, it feels very much like it could have come out in 1969 as an annual or a giant-sized X-Men.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Giant-sized X-Men. Giant-sized Fantastic Four or something like that. And I think we would have all enjoyed it immensely.
Mm-hmm.
Especially with Neil Adams on the art, because he could have done the art.
Yeah.
In 1970. I read an interview on Newsarama where I think they were really snippy about the artwork. They were saying it wasn't a patch on Adams in his heyday. And I actually disagree with that. I think there are places where it's better than his early stuff.
Right.
I think some of it... I'm not a fan of the thing having this many teeth.
Quite grotesque in places.
Yeah, and it's a weird choice that. That's always an artistic decision for the artist to either go with teeth or not.
Mm.
And it depends who the artist is.
Yeah.
He has teeth in the film,
okay,
which I thought was quite interesting. But there are some close-ups like that, him and Sue, that I think are genuinely good.
Yeah.
And when he's going full treasury, you know, when he's got Annihilus blasting out the Negative Zone or Galactus eating planets,
yeah,
it's full-on Neil Adams genius.
Oh, yeah. And that's what I'm saying. This isn't bad Neil Adams,
yeah,
but this is obviously Neil Adams who has gotten much older.
Right.
And the first kind of comparison that popped into my head initially was, let's say John Romita Jr.
Yeah.
He's obviously nowhere near as old as Neil Adams was when he did this.
Well, he can't be far off.
Mm, but JR's art has evolved to a degree where it's not as good, and he's not got the, well, I'm older now argument to back up how he's devolved artistically,
yeah,
in my opinion. Whereas here, this is someone who's attempting to do their A game, but can't, because they are older.
Hmm.
It's not that this is bad Neil Adams, this is great Neil Adams, he's just a different artist because he's older.
I know that's the best way of putting it, he's a different artist at this point. I don't think any of this sucks.
No.
Yeah, I think that the shot of the Silver Surfer is gorgeous.
And I think the colouring's doing a lot. Neil Adams isn't someone who I'd say benefits from modern colouring, but the modern colouring helps a lot in this.
Mm-hmm.
It brings a vibe and feel to it.
Yeah.
That I think really just enhances the artwork much more, especially with it being on a larger scale.
Yeah. Mm, all right, okay. There's minor similarities and minor disagreements there. I like that it opened in media res and then just carried on going.
Mm.
There have been, I've seen some complaints of the Superman movie that it started like that, and some people have said, but what's happening? I didn't understand it. And you're like, there is literally a caption at the beginning telling you what happened. There's literally a Star Wars scroll.
Right, okay.
Telling you what occurred to lead up to this situation.
Yeah.
I personally don't think it needed that. The film gives you enough context
yeah.
as you go along, but you have to have the patience to go along with it and learn that that's what's happened.
Yeah.
And I think the filmmakers have gone, nah, we're going to have to tell them what's happened.
Right, okay.
So, all right, fine, that's the choice they made. But I think that this starting and just carrying on was all to its benefit. Annihilus showing up in the teaser pretty much ensures that he's going to be back before the end of the thing because they're in the negative zone.
Oh, yeah.
And if you're in the negative zone, who are you encountering? If it isn't, Blastar the Living Bombus, who I love. I love Blastar. I think Adams does wring all the tension out of the scene where the FF stopped the meteorite hitting the Earth. The meteorite being the Silver Surfer and him exclaiming Galactus is dead. If you were reading this monthly, that is a fantastic cliffhanger.
I mean, that's your pre-credit sequence there, yeah. isn't it?
Galactus is dead. And the only problem I have with that in the Treasury is straight into the next page.
Mm.
Which is, it still works.
Yeah.
But it's a brilliant cliffhanger. He does all that later. I'm liking this modern characterization that Sue is the team leader when Reed's not around. And even sometimes when Reed is around
yeah.
and he's busy working the science, Sue takes charge.
Yeah.
And none of the others have a problem with that. And I much prefer this Sue to the simpering sycophant she was in the 60s.
Yeah, yeah.
What does it all mean? Oh, I'm going shopping. Oh, for God's sake.
But I think on the characterisation here, we're starting to see Wade is seeding Reed's character arc within this. With I've forgotten a word. Oh, da, 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 da. And I didn't like that. But unless you buy that, you don't get the plot.
Mm.
Because it's him believing that, oh, I've forgotten a couple of things. I must be stupid. I will become Galactus. That, for me, just felt really dumb and out of place, but you've got to accept it for the plot to work.
Actually do. Although I did love How Can You Love Someone Who's So Stupid?
Yeah.
Well, I love Johnny.
Yeah.
That's a funny line.
And I just, and especially since the climax of that was just, you're not stupid, you've just had a second child and you're a bit all over the place. It didn't work, that entire story arc, which is the climax of the story, just didn't work for me.
See, I get what you're saying there. I just rode with it, because like you say, if you don't ride with it,
yeah.
that's essentially the plot.
But it sticks out enough. It's like Wade wants you to clock on that this is going to be important.
Yeah.
There's a bit where he just stops and he puts his hand on his head and he's like, I've forgotten a word, I'm really stupid. And it feels like Wade wants you to catch on to it.
Mm.
It's not seeded or as subtle as it could have been.
Do you think that's because it's a 4-issue mini?
So you've
and
got,
if it
you've
had
got
been
to,
a long-running subplot that bloomed here,
yeah.
that may have been more impressive. I don't know, it may have been. It's possible. I mean, Wade goes for broke. This isn't the last time he'd write the FF, but he knew it was the only time he'd do it with Neil Adams, so he makes every page bigger. It starts big
yeah,
and just gets bigger and bigger and bigger as it goes along. So in that respect, it's a proper treasury.
Yeah, he's definitely writing it with Adams in mind.
Do you think they knew they were going to publish this at this size? When they did the miniseries, but they didn't just want to release this.
Potentially.
Because you don't get Neil Adams on a book if you're not going to do something special with it.
Mm.
And as much as we're like, well, it's not really a treasury, this. I don't know what it is, but it's not a treasury. It still emphasises his artwork.
Yeah. We've just turned onto this page here. This stuck out.
Where Reed becomes Galactus.
This irritated me.
Why?
So much. From an artistic decision. Because we all know Galactus's design, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So why then, when Reed becomes Galactus, is there a gap between his head and the helmet?
It's like he's not brought it down far enough.
Yeah.
That's like his eyes should be where his hair is.
Yeah, that just kind of stuck out for me. It just wound me up the more I saw it. Galactus just having hair.
Yeah.
It's like, no, this is wrong. This feels wrong.
Yeah, if Reed has become Galactus, why is he not just wearing the same costume, albeit with a 4 on it?
Yeah.
So, I get that. That design is a little bit, that is a bit silly. And showing that they're all drinking from the same well, this is very similar to the Fantastic Four Superman treasury that Michael Bailey and I just talked about.
Hmm.
In that one, Galactus is after Superman as his herald.
Right.
And Superman gets the power cosmic.
Okay.
And the FF have to stop him.
Yeah.
Whereas here, the FF get the power cosmic. And it's a superficial similarity,
mm.
but it's interesting to note in light of A, everyone in comics is pissing in the same pond, let's be honest, or drinking from the same well, if you want to be slightly less vulgar. But it's also interesting in what we've already discussed as the similarities between the films, that these two stories should have similar ideas as well. I mean, I'm not saying in any way Mark Wade copied what Dan Jurgens did in that Treasurer. I don't think he did, because it's different enough.
Well, I think that I had this thought. Galactus seems to be the kind of the big Fantastic Four story that you kind of generally think of. And having reread the Galactus trilogy, as I laughingly refer to, I gave myself further reading for this episode because facsimiles for those had just come out. And
they're a good read.
Yeah. But the thing that kind of stuck out to me is that Galactus is just like Doomsday or Bane, and that he's a very one-note villain. Yeah. And all of his stories are just more or less the same. And I read a criticism of this that I kind of actually agreed with to an extent, is that by taking the person out of Galactus and making him Galen, you've removed from, I guess, the kind of majesty and the fear by kind of humanizing it and making him essentially a coward.
Yes.
And that's always it's always a kind of interesting story arc to go through. You've got someone with a great deal of power who is actually a coward hiding behind that power.
Yeah.
But I don't think I like the humanization, the literal humanization of Galactus into a cowering wimp. And I feel like it's an interesting concept to explore further from that one-note Galactus story. It's just not inherently one that I would have... That it's not an avenue that I would have liked to have been explored, because I think it takes away from Galactus.
See, it's interesting, because I came at that from a completely different angle.
Right.
That I didn't like what the Fantastic Four do to Galen at the end of this.
Well, they just chuck him back in.
Yeah, he does not want to go back to being Galactus.
They don't try and solve the problem.
No, he's very much... No, I'm free of it.
Yeah.
It's with Reed now.
Yeah.
They do with me. Bye! And there's a part of you that can see that point of view. So I didn't necessarily read it as cowardice, more of, I've done my bit for Queen and Country.
Well, it's more, they're just saying that to be Galactus is a curse. And the implication really is that Galactus isn't the person. Galactus is like a burden that's passed on.
Yeah, but Galactus is also a force of nature, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I get what you're saying. But the fact that the Fantastic Four basically force him to go back to being Galactus really rubbed me the wrong way.
Because we've only got a couple of pages left.
Yeah, that's what it reeked of. We've only four pages left. Wrap it up.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're reading that as a homage to Stan Lee, then fine. But they didn't even try to find a way to help Galen.
Yeah.
It was, no, you're Galactus, suck it up.
And I think the focus on it was more on Reed Richards going, I'll kill off the power of Galactus by killing myself.
Yeah.
And that didn't feel like a fix. That didn't feel like Reed Richards. That didn't feel like I'm going to solve a problem that is in front of me. This just felt like I'm just going to stop it right now. I can't think of anything else. So I'll just, end it.
And maybe there would have been, because there must be lots of uninhabited planets.
Yeah.
That he can eat. Because in the book that I mentioned earlier, the James Lovegrove book, he establishes that Galactus needs planets that are verdant.
Right.
And he passes the Skrull homeworld because they're essentially turned it into Coruscant.
Right.
So it's just this big industrialised planet that, like, it's like a McDonald's to him. He could eat it.
Yeah.
But it wouldn't sustain him.
Yeah.
So he needs a planet that is like Earth, that is verdant and abundant in water and atmosphere and all that stuff. That's as good an explanation as any.
Well, Stan and Jack point out in 49 that he starts with the oceans. He eats the oceans first. Yeah. So, yeah, you're just bouncing off that, aren't you?
Yeah, so that's not a bad idea. So, yeah, okay. I just that did leave a sour taste in my mouth. Did you notice that for one page, Reed and Sue lose their gloves?
I did notice that, yes.
Because it's such a weird choice.
Because they're drawn.
That's not a mistake.
Figures. He's drawing literal detailed hands.
Yeah.
And then a couple of pages, they've just got gloves on.
They've got the gloves, though.
Yeah.
They don't take them off. They've no gloves on for one page.
Well, I noticed because the FF costumes look weird.
Without the gloves.
Without the gloves.
Yeah. It is one of those things that you don't realise it's an integral part of the uniform.
Until it's taken away.
Until they've not got it. And weirdly, they don't wear gloves in the film, but you don't really care.
Well, they're different costumes, aren't they?
Yeah, they're different costumes. So, mostly, yeah, The resolution lies with mankind's capacity for good, which becomes more and more laughable every day. But again, similar to the film. Mm. There's the how humanity view the FF in this is similar to the movie. I'd like you to say I mostly enjoyed it. I breezed through it in one sitting. I didn't have a problem with Neil's artwork in this. I think there are some cases where it's better than his old stuff. And there are some cases like you where I think it's not. And there are inconsistencies. Like, you can't seem to get Sue right from page to page.
No.
Even her hairstyle changes. But for the most part, I very much enjoyed it. As a Treasury edition, mm-hmm. summer special, giant-sized issue that you pick up as an extra.
Yeah.
I thoroughly enjoyed it. In addition to featuring the alternate covers, including some by Alex Ross that have no bearing on, why is Medusa here?
They're just these... Didn't he do a whole run?
I think he did, yeah. I don't know, to be honest with you. The Treasury edition includes, as Michael mentioned, reprints of issue 65 from 1969 of X-Men. Denny O'Neill and Neil Adams. It's an interesting inclusion, this, because it deals with the same themes as the main story.
Okay.
That humanity is capable of greatness when they pool their capacity for empathy and caring rather than their greed or desire for power. So, thematically, I get why they included it. But if you look at this, I don't know how you can look at this and say this is better than what we just saw. Because I don't think in this issue of X-Men he's become Neil Adams yet.
Yeah.
I don't think this is as good as his Batman work. And this is just before his Batman work, isn't it?
Mm.
Or thereabout. And then they include Fantastic Four issue 60 by Mark Waid and Mike Maringo, one of the best issues of the Fantastic Four ever. And it's lovely to see where Ingo's art in Treasury sized. That was a nice inclusion. And I read all of that. I read those two as well.
I didn't.
Did you not?
No.
Oh, shocking.
I didn't. It's one of those things. They felt like, obviously, the X-Men's included because it's Neil Adams.
Yeah.
And it's Mark Waid because it's Mark Waid.
But you've also got the thing, but what else could they include
it? But that's it. I don't think that they should have. But also, at the same time, you've got to bump up the page count to justify releasing it in the first place.
Yes. And, you know, it's fine. I mean, I think maybe a Thor, they possibly didn't have the rights with Conan.
Yeah.
But thematically, like I said, the story matches.
Yeah.
So that's probably why that one mapped. Fantastic Four issue 51, This Man, This Monster, by Stan Lee and Jack Kirby. From the Penguin hardcover that we mentioned earlier on. I've got a big synopsis here. Do we really need to read a synopsis to this? Isn't this one of those issues everybody's read?
Maybe someone's
read it. All right. A morose and downhearted Ben Grimm is taken in from the rain by a man who transfers Ben's power as the Thing into himself. Reed couldn't do this, but... what the hell, this is Marvel land. Posing as the Thing, the strange man goes over to the Baxter building to destroy Reed, who, the man feels, makes his discoveries for power, money and glory. The real Ben tries to warn Reed, who blows him off. Reed continues his investigation into the newly discovered portal to the Negative Zone, an antimatter universe. But despite being tethered to his own universe, the Zone's dangers cause Reed to become untethered and hopelessly lost in space. The ersatz Thing, having realised Reed is actually quite altruistic, follows Reed in and hurls Reed back to safety, leaving him trapped there for all time. Rather conveniently, and without explanation, the real Ben turns back into the Thing, implying ersatz Thing is dead, and returns to the Baxter building where Reed and Sue realise that the friend who they were just mourning is actually still alive and well. The imposter that was posing as them, whoever he was, had died a hero. It was all right, wasn't it? FF52 is generally regarded to be one of the finest issues created during the almost legendary run by Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, and it starts with a cover so iconic that it doesn't feature loads of unnecessary word balloons because Stan knew what he was being given there.
Yeah.
The only thing more iconic than that cover is the splash page, which may be the best single piece of Fantastic Four artwork that Jack Kirby ever did discuss.
Sure.
It did. You can't argue. It's just lovely. And there's nothing to it. It is literally a Thing stood in the rain.
Yeah.
And that's it. And he drew portals to the Negative Zone and Galactus descending from the skies and Annihilus's little bird thing swooping in to attack New York City. And yet that's one of the best pieces of work he ever produced.
It's very Will Eisner.
Yeah.
Over dramatic rain. And the funny thing is, reading this immediately after reading issue 50.
Yeah.
Is that all of this melodrama comes down to just Ben misinterpreting the scene with Alicia and the Silver Surfer.
Yeah.
Which is great melodrama because it's on the back of something really so stupid.
Yeah.
It's like when you watch a bunch of teen dramas and it's like, you could solve all of your problems if you just communicated to each other, if you just spoke to each other.
You just went out for a coffee.
Yeah.
And had a chat.
And so you've got great peak Jack Kirby on the back of peak melodrama Stan Lee.
Yeah.
It's like they're working on their A game here, but not for the reasons that you think they'd be. It's great.
Yeah. And he does, this isn't his first appearance, he does appear in issue 50, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Setting this issue up, but that don't matter.
Which again was really funny, the Galactus trilogy, which is...
Which isn't.
Duology in three books.
It's 48 pages.
Because they stop it halfway through issue 50.
Yeah.
And then it's just pages of barely connected teasers.
And, yeah.
Including this...
Johnny goes to college.
Yeah. It's like, see, his first day. It's like...
Well, fascinating.
I will get my revenge on the Fantastic Four. It's like, oh, who's this guy?
Yeah, sometimes, I've said this to you before, sometimes they publish that Galactus trilogy and they cut the beginning off and they cut the end off and they just focus on the middle bit, maybe put a new splash page on or whatever, and it works fine.
It'd probably work better because, you know, you read in 48 and it's like, what's going on with the Inhumans? We've moved on, we've forgotten about them now.
And then it's literally, isn't it? We've moved on now. Forgot about them.
We're done with Galactus, but we've got 11 pages left.
Yeah. I mean, Stan Lee must have loved that splash because even he doesn't cover it with dialogue.
Yeah.
Which is rare for Stan. It is implausible that this man, whose name we never learn in this story.
Yes.
We learn it later, but we never learn it in this story, claims to be as brilliant as Reed, and he actually manages to accomplish what Reed has never achieved. He cures Ben.
He cures him, but he doesn't cure him. He just moves the problem onto someone else.
Well, yeah, but Reed's never done that.
And it's great because there's the bits of dialogue from the thing that seeds what's actually happening.
Mm.
It's like, oh, I feel like I'm being drawn to somewhere. And then it's like, oh, I feel like...
Yeah, that was really very weak.
I feel like I'm really tired. I kind of liked it because... At least then it's not just a case of convenience.
Yeah.
Ben's just not conveniently walking to this place. Like, I use my hypnotic ray to persuade him to come here. It's like, okay, fair. That's weak, but it works. I get it. Like, what's this guy's grand plan to just wait for Ben to just walk past?
Yeah, that is true. It's like he's just waiting for him to wander by.
Yeah.
So, all right. Yeah,
but it's such a weirdly... cruel decision as well, because he's issues with Reed.
Yeah.
He's
cruelly, not got any problem with Ben.
He's cruelly weaponizing Ben to get to Reed, which makes him a kind of horrible... I mean, he'll redeem himself later, as we'll see. But yes, this is just a horrible plan where he's like, I'm going to temporarily cure Ben Grimm's affliction to get at someone else.
And what was his plan for when Ben came back? To say, look, he's not the thing I am.
Yeah.
He doesn't have one, does he?
And he also masters his voice and dialect.
In very short amount of time.
Suddenly, it's like, Aunt Petunia, you dislike the Nancy, the Yancy Street gang. It's like, is he just been doing a lot of research?
It's beat the crap out of you. No, it's clobbering you.
Yeah.
Well, the thing with that as well, in a world where Skrulls exist,
yeah,
Sue and Reed at no point give him any credibility when Ben shows up going, no, I'm Ben.
Yeah, it's like, look, I've got my driver's license on me.
Yeah, but have you got your birth certificate? And, yeah, there's a lot of it that you can rip the piss out of. There's little things as well, like you can understand why Sue considered having an affair a lot of times in the 60s, because Reed is just a prick.
I love Stan, and it's very rare for me to say that I enjoy Stan's dialogue, but I love his... with like arguing, bickering dialogue between Reed and Sue.
I'd say that's I can never totally completely dismiss Stan's contributions, because a lot of it is the dialogue made the characters.
Yeah.
And sometimes his dialogue is inadvertently hysterical.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's just hysterical. I mean, and he walks that fine line between being self-aware enough to know that he's ever so slightly mocking, isn't he?
Yeah.
So it's clever. And one of the things I did love about it, and I do love it, we're mocking it ever so slightly, but only, you know, because we love it. Jim Shooter, RIP, had this rule, apparently, that in every issue, the characters had to use their powers and had to explain how they got them.
Which is why you get this scene with Johnny.
But no, that's my point. They don't use their powers in this at all.
Yeah.
Sue never does.
Mm.
Reed doesn't.
Mm.
He stretches once or twice, but you know, the thing crushes something once and that's it.
Yeah.
Johnny just flames his thumb on.
Yeah.
And that's it. And there's never any who... They don't even appear together as a team.
No.
At any point in this story.
I mean, I could have done without Johnny at college. And this...
Yeah, but even, Stan forgot about all this.
Well, even in issue 50 as well, you get it. It just feels so out of place. And you feel like you're watching a backdoor pilot as well, because you've got the coach who has to sit down and explain his story. No, you don't understand, my wife. It's that Johnny Storm is with the son of my former partner and I need to train him. It's like, to fulfill my legacy. It's like, wow, Stan, lay it on thick, man. Come on.
Well, if it makes you feel any better, that didn't go anywhere.
No, it doesn't. That makes me feel worse then. Why is it that?
They completely forget about Whitey Mullins.
What?
And that name needs some work. Should have workshopped that a bit more.
Yeah.
They completely forget about the coach.
Right.
Wyatt ends up going off with the Fantastic Four to explore the hidden land or whatever. I don't remember.
Right.
And he ends up staying with them as Johnny's best mate.
Okay.
And they never bother going back to college.
Cool. Great. Thanks for that then, Stan.
It's like you said, it's like they were throwing some crap at the wall with like, well, can we do with Johnny what we've done with Peter Parker?
Yeah.
And they quickly went, no, we can't do that. So it's fair enough. But I genuinely thought that Stan thinking Sue's woman's intuition is a superpower is hysterical.
So got some great Kirby bits in here with these, these weird, wacky, improbable designs for some stuff.
Yeah.
We get one of the collage pages, which... I have this kind of, I love them.
I love them.
I really do, because I think that there literally nothing else looks like this at the time. And I think he would do it better in some of the Jimmy Olsen stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But it looks out of place, but it intentionally looks out of place. Like, it looks like one of those things that is what I'm looking at good or comprehensible. But then at the same time, it looks completely incomprehensible to the characters as well. So
yeah.
It does what it's supposed to do.
I loved it when he'd do his photo collages.
Yeah.
Even in grimy black and white and British reprints.
I prefer it. I don't think the colouring works.
Well, the colouring is of its time, isn't it?
Mm.
You know, I mean, if they did that nowadays, they would colour it a lot better.
I think,
but I don't think anyone would do it because they've got Photoshop now, aren't they?
Especially for the negative zone, though.
Yeah.
The black and white stuff, the black and white collage stuff, I think would look better.
Mm. Oh, yeah, I love his collages. And a lot of the art in this is great. And even this, you're not quite at peak Kirby yet.
We're getting there.
Yeah, he's very definitely getting there, but you're not quite there yet. But yeah, I love this issue. And the only reason that we've covered this issue is because it leads directly into, we talk about that, talk about this, Fantastic Four Full Circle, a fully painted graphic novel.
No, it's not painted.
Oh, no, you're absolutely right. Yeah, that is an important distinction. This is not Alex Ross painting stuff.
Mm.
This is pencils, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, by
pencils
Alex Ross.
And flats.
Came out September 6th, 2022. When the Baxter Building is invaded by a parasitic life form, the Fantastic Four leap into action to stop it. When they get it on the table, Reed discovers it's a life form and a very familiar one. The man who stole Ben's body some time ago and was lost in the negative zone. Reed decides to lead the FF into the zone to find out the origins of the creature and if it's a Vanguard 2 invasion, as they said on the Phantom Menace trailer. It's interesting to compare the Alex Ross version of The Thing to Neil Adams. Ross gives him no teeth.
No.
At all. Adams draws a monster, Ross draws a heavily built man.
Yeah.
Yeah, both work.
Mm.
Both are really good.
So this was published under the Marvel Arts banner, and
yeah.
I think it's still the only book to be published under the Marvel Arts banner, unless you're including the Full Circle Expanded Edition.
Yeah. But I think you're right.
What I think is quite interesting about it is Ross does the origin, but he's not wasting any page count. He does it as the dust jacket.
Yeah.
And it works. It's really comprehensive. It is the origin for all of them with the emphasis on Ben because he's essentially the anchor point of the story.
Yeah.
And it's one of those genius things where you're including within the book outside of the book, the origin story.
Well, that's what he did with his DC treasuries as well.
Yeah.
And this is the only painted bit of the book.
Yeah.
That's standard Alex Ross. I don't know why he draws the FF uniforms with that sheen. Because I always got the impression from Kirby they were cloth.
Yeah.
Even though they're unstable molecules.
Mm.
But, you know, but yeah, it's a beautiful two pages. As you would expect from Alex Ross, it's very well done. I do love how many of these special stories for the FF lean into Galactus, the Silver Surfer, the Negative Zone and ILS. Yeah. I love how many of them have scenes of Ben eating and then being denied his food.
Yeah.
In this, he's making like a Scooby snack. Not that kind. Johnny and Ben pranking each other, Reed and Sue's supportive marriage, Reed's genius being the catalyst. I love that they start exactly the same as FF51.
Mm.
A monster in the rain outside of a building.
Yeah.
That's a nice
and
touch.
It would end up being the actual guy who would bring Ben in from the rain.
Yeah.
I think it says a lot about Alex Ross as well. He's not known for being a writer. I don't think he's ever written before, has he? He might have
co-plotted. There's an issue of Kingdom Come spin-off called the Superman one that he wrote.
Yeah. But considering that, I mean, with the caveats, plot-wise, character-wise, I think he nails the Fantastic Four.
Mm.
He does a really good job of nailing the family-ness of them and the dialogue between them. For someone who's not known for being a writer, he writes them really well.
Yeah. Well, so again, some of the reviews I read, I did some deep dive into both of these. There's less on Antithesis, weirdly, than there is on this. Alex Ross did a lot of interviews for this.
Yeah.
And there's even a brilliant YouTube video of him in his art department showing you how he did it all.
Okay.
That's worth a watch. There were some reviews that were very snippy about the writing. I found it fine.
Yeah.
Like you said, it's not as campy or melodramatic as Stan Lee.
Yeah.
And he's nowhere near as good as Mark Waid.
Mm.
But the story's clear.
To the story...
Like, yeah, the characters all sound like the characters.
Yeah. And I mean, I feel like the story itself... I don't know if this was just me. The story didn't seem to go anywhere.
Mm.
It bounced from... Like, there was no plot. There was no kind of central arc or narrative. We bounce from point to point and then return to the original point.
Yeah.
And then we're done. It's like, oh, and now we're going to reintroduce this character and now we're going to have this villain and now we're back to this villain and now we're back to where we started. The plot wasn't as strong as the dialogue. The dialogue was carrying a lot of this book for me. Mm. And it's the same with the art as well. We're seeing very... interesting version of Alex Ross that we've never seen before.
Yeah,
with the pencils and then the flat colours on that. That you've got a visually striking book, but not necessarily one that's clear or easy to understand in places. It's quite muddy in some places.
Well, do you know where the colouring came from?
Go on.
He read a British reprint.
Right.
Of, I think it was This Man, This Monster. It was a Fantastic Four annual from like the 60s or 70s. One of our annuals, not one of the American ones. And in true British reprint fashion,
they
bollocksed up the colouring.
Of course.
So it was this two-tone red and orange and black instead of being full colour. But Alex Ross liked the cocked-up colouring.
Right.
So much because he thought it gave it this 60s psychedelic
but
appeal.
It does, and that's the thing. It's visually stunning and striking, and you're seeing colour schemes and palettes that should not work. You've got garish yellows against greens and pinks, and it shouldn't work, but it does.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there's an element of muddiness to it that doesn't make it the clearest.
So he is effectively... incredibly well replicating a crappy British reprint.
Yeah.
But he's doing it like as high art.
Yeah.
And it's brilliant. I love that. I love that he liked the fact that we cocked up the printing, but he loved that cock up.
Yeah.
He loved the mistake of it. And he made this based on a mistake. I love that. Because it does look lovely. He mimics Kirby wonderfully in a collage entering the Negative Zone.
Mm.
Does he use photo reference there, do you think? Or has he painted that background?
It looks like Kirby's collages but painted, doesn't it?
Yeah, I don't know. We've not got the extended edition.
Yeah.
Again, I watched a YouTube video where someone reviewed that.
Mm.
It's this. And then a reprint of This Man, This Monster.
Yeah.
And then, like, full-on deep dive from Alex Ross into how he did it.
Yeah, yeah.
Blah, blah, blah. And then this again, but just the pencils.
Yeah.
And then this again with the inks. So you get the full process of how we created it. But I cannot for the life of me remember maybe I got distracted when I was watching it, whether this is photos or whether this is the only painted page of the book.
I mean, Alex Ross weirdly does Jack Kirby really well.
Oh, he does excellent Jack Kirby.
The bits, and the polar opposite, the complete opposite ends of the spectrum. But you get the bit earlier on when he's recapping issue 51, and that looks painted. But you've got readers working on the machine that he was working on in 51. So there's a great deal of attention to detail. But Ross makes the Kirby machinery work and look real as well.
Yeah.
He does a really good job of imitating and enhancing Kirby-isms.
Kirby tech.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting as well. There was a behind-the-scenes thing interview that I was reading with him where this was mooted a while ago. He said, well, do you want to do a Fantastic Four special with Stan?
Right.
And Alex was like, so I do all the hard work and Stan comes along and dialogues it and takes all the credit?
Yeah.
No. Right. No, thank you. So he turned that down. And so then it was a couple of years before this came up again. And that's why he wrote this.
Mm.
He wanted to learn from Jack Kirby's mistakes.
Right.
I'm not going to all this effort to then have somebody come along as the co-writer and get a lot of the credit for what is essentially my story, my plot. I've paced it. I've done all the work. So if I'm going to do it, I'm going to write it as well.
Yeah.
And that's where it came from. And he was on about, he was doing like 2 or 3 pages a week in addition to when he was doing all the covers. He had a contract deal with Marvel, so he was doing Fantastic Four covers and Spider-Man covers and all that stuff. I think he updates Kirby wonderfully. It's interesting, one of the things he noticed, you won't have got this, his Reed Richards, you know he uses a lot of photo reference.
Yeah.
And sometimes he'll draw his friends and other times he'll draw contemporary actors.
Mm.
For this one, he drew the guy who was the lead of the 1960 TV show Land of the Giants.
Okay.
And he actually got in touch with him.
Yeah.
And asked him, is this okay? He didn't do a Sam Jackson or a Simon Pegg thing where they just drew him and hoped they wouldn't sue.
Yeah.
And thankfully they didn't. In this one, he actually got in touch with the actor who's Gary Conway, who was at that point still alive.
Okay.
And said, look, I want to use your face for this graphic novel. Are you okay with that? And he was like, yeah, sure. Go for your life.
I mean, Alex Ross, he's very much rooted in 60s art style. And that really works for Fantastic Four. And the thing is, as well, is his mum was a fashion designer. So Alex Ross knows how to
serve clothes work
with his clothing and his fashion. Yeah. And that just really shows, even though it's only just a costume, like just a one-piece costume, the design of the fashion and the clothing, even the normal clothing that they wears, he does it really well because he was born to, I guess.
Yeah. And some of it's really cool. Again, I really enjoyed this. I like that he doesn't portray Reed as a dick, which always seems to be the default for a lot of people who don't really get it.
Yeah.
He's a man consumed by his sense of urgency to know the unknowable.
Yeah.
And the rest of the team cut him some slack when he becomes laser focused on what he's doing.
And he's a lot friendlier and empathetic in this as he is in some of the other ones as well. When they're talking about the guy who imitated Ben, he's like, oh yes, but you have to understand, Ben, he was actually quite good when he does this, but I understand how stealing your identity could make you feel a bit shitty.
Yeah.
And like, he's a much nicer, friendlier version of Reed in this.
Yeah, I think he does great. I mean, if anything, it's Johnny that gets short shrift in this, isn't it?
Yeah.
He's not really important to the adventure. His powers provide a couple of interesting visual flourishes, but mostly it is about Reed and Sue, and then Ben re-meeting that guy.
Yeah.
Because that's what Ben calls him.
Yeah.
That guy. He does give a name, doesn't he? He's Ricardo or something,
Ricardo,
isn't
he? Yeah.
Ricardo Jones or something like that. So he does get a name. You do have to ask yourself the question, does Fantastic Four 51 need a sequel?
No, but what I actually liked, because I read this roughly when it came out, and then reread it after 51. I don't think it does, but I think this works as a sequel because this fills in some blanks that maybe Stan and Kirby didn't care about. Mm. He's got a name now. He gives him a happy ending. There's unnecessary but nice closure that this book gives issue 51.
And especially as Reed gives him a redesigned suit as well, so he can live much more normally.
Yeah.
So Reed does him that favour at the end.
This answers questions that no one was ever asking, but it does it in such a way that
you're happy you have those answers.
Yeah.
That's fair enough. I enjoyed this. I enjoyed this because it doesn't lean into the soap opera. I enjoyed this because it's like Antithesis. It's a long-form graphic novel adventure where he leans into the idea it's a family of explorers. And again, I sat down and I breezed through it all in one go.
It's very breezy, yeah.
Yeah.
I just really wish that maybe he might have had a co-writer, because I do feel like it's a... Oh, it's the guy from 51 again. Okay, now we're going to sneak around in Nihilus's lair. Okay, now we've got the Janus. Okay, and now we're back to doing this again.
But do you not think that's very Stan? And Jack.
I suppose.
All right, I'm bored of this now. Let's move on to the next thing.
Because it just felt, and that's the thing, I don't feel like this book has a plot. It has a beginning and an end, and then we just meander for a bit.
Again? I feel that that's very, very much redolent of 60s Marvel comics.
Okay, I guess, yeah.
So, you know.
And then we just get to this little epilogue at the end where Reed does this great big monologue and Ben just goes, shut up, man.
Dude, we went, we came, we saw, we got back in one piece.
Yeah.
Just let it go.
Yeah.
And this is the only thing that dates it. There's a gag, there's a hashtag gag, and they've got two kids.
Right.
Other than that, this could take place anywhere as long as it's after FF51.
Yeah. Artistically, I very much put this in the 60s.
Yeah, but they've got two kids.
Mm.
So, and there's only
multiverse.
One...
multiverse.
Well, yeah, I mean, like you say, I think this is well worth a read. It was in HMV and reduced to a fiver.
Okay.
I don't know whether that was just clear out because of the new version.
Yeah, yeah.
But then the film came out, so they put it back to $17.99.
Of course.
Of course they did. But if you haven't read this, this is easier to find than Antithesis.
Yeah.
Because they must have printed this out the wazoo. We are going to have the return of...
continuity and nitpicks.
Yes, indeed. Just for this one-off. Because largely, there's not a lot of them.
Well, no, it exists outside of
Alex
the timeline,
Ross,
doesn't it?
Alex Ross knows his stuff.
Yeah.
So there's not a lot of continuity in nitpicks. We've mentioned that it's a semi-sequel to FF51 in that guy makes a return.
Mm-hmm.
It also relies quite heavily on Fantastic Four 107 and 108, The Mysterious Mystery of the Nega Man.
Yes.
That's going to very interest history. Do you know all about that?
No.
Okay. When Jack left the book with issue 102, he'd completed another issue.
Okay.
He completed issue 103.
Right.
Stan held that back.
Right.
Completely restructured it. Had John Buscema redraw bits.
Okay.
Create additional panels. Create an entirely separate story to lead into that issue that was then told as a flashback to a previous adventure that we didn't see.
Right.
And Ross recreates a lot of these additional panels in here. He does homage John Buscema as well as Jack Kirby.
Okay.
Which is quite interesting. In later years, they reconstructed it back to what it was.
Right.
And released it as Kirby originally intended it to be released.
Okay.
It's all very... Yeah. I don't know why. The Big Splash Pert of Annihilus is taken from annual number 6.
Right.
And there's obviously a lot of remakes of panels. FF51, as you've mentioned, is in here. A lot of the Negative Zone references rip straight from other comics.
Mm-hmm.
If you get the expanded version, mm-hmm. which is why I've not gone into in detail here, they do it. They do that for
the
us.
The commentary.
This panel is from here and this panel is from here and so on and so forth.
I love that stuff. Like, well, have you been picking up the new History of the DC Universe?
No, I'm going to get the trade of that.
Half of it is commentary and annotations.
All right.
Love it. Great.
Okay, well, I'll either read yours or I'll get the collected edition. Ross leaves it ambiguous as the placement of this in continuity, which we've talked about. Reed and Sue are both kids.
Yeah.
So that's not a continuity or nitpick, is it?
Mm.
You could drop this in anywhere after Jonathan Hickman's run.
Yeah.
And it fits. Or after Mark Waid, he had two kids in Mark Waid's run, didn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah, so anywhere though, because you don't see Franklin and Valeria's face.
No.
So you don't know how old they are.
But I do like that they've got a picture of themselves with, that's definitely the Kirby Spider-Man, I think.
Well, Franklin loves Spider-Man, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Franklin's like that, was really tight with Spider-Man.
They're good mates.
They're good mates, yeah, because, well, let's be honest, Spider-Man's sense of humour is right on Franklin's level, isn't it? So that's fair enough. So the continuity and nitpicks, I'm glad we brought it back, but there's not really a lot to pick apart in this, is there? Ross does a good job. Ross did one of those interviews that I said, this is a very prophetic line from him. I'm like most fans, where they keep saying they want the film set in the 60s, and then you can do whatever amount of material you want with them being the only superheroes in their own time period. And then you can have them time travel if you want them to cross over, but you don't need that. But to have them in that time period would be wonderful because of the aesthetics of stuff like we watched on Mad Men. Can you imagine if that was brought to life in a contemporary film with the Fantastic Four? I can only imagine Marvel Brain Trust, whoever they are now, Kevin Feige and whoever he's got in his writing room, read that and went, do you know what? Why are we avoiding comparisons with The Incredibles? We were here first. Yeah. The Incredibles ripped us off.
Yeah.
Not the other way around. And it did feel like, they never address it, but it does feel like the film just goes, yeah, well, like The Incredibles, we were here first, deal with it.
So now that this new film is out,
yeah,
is Incredibles still the best Fantastic Four film?
It never was. The Incredibles was not the best, because it's not the Fantastic Four.
It is.
No, it isn't.
It is.
No, it isn't. It's a pastiche.
Yeah.
It's not the Fantastic Four.
It was still the best Fantastic Four film.
It's the best film redolent of the Fantastic Four. It is the best film that uses the Fantastic Four as its template.
Yeah.
And I would argue The Incredibles is still a better film than First Class.
Okay.
But it's not the Fantastic Four.
Okay.
A pastiche isn't that thing.
Okay.
It isn't.
Yeah.
It just isn't. Okay. I'm sorry. I do like that they got Michael Giacchino to do the music to the Fantastic Four, though.
Right.
That made me laugh. I thought, well, see what you're doing there. Right. Okay, that's it for this week.
Yes.
I think we'd, and we brought that in at what? 90 minutes.
Because we're professionals.
We are exceptionally
good at this.
I can't speak, but we're exceptionally professional at this. Next time, our all new episode of Hey Kids Comics. We've not got a clue, have we?
We don't know.
We have literally...
We've been slacking.
We've been slacking because I'm still working my way through Lone Wolf.
Mm.
And we do want to do that, but we want to read it all before we do it. And we've not actually got a plan for next month. So you just show up, guys, and your guess will be as good as ours. But that'll be fun.
Although
we can do an email show.
Yeah. They'll already know, though.
They will, because they'll see the little email picture of you going... Oh!
I can't believe that they did this.
You'll be shocked by whatever bollocks that you're going to be shocked by this week. So we'll see you next time for a brand new Hey Kids Comics. And I know that we're a little bit late tying in with the FF movie and Michael hasn't actually seen it, but it doesn't matter, does it, really?
Not really.
Nobody cares.
You can listen to this whenever you want.
Yeah, that's true. It'll be there forever. Along with all our old episodes on archive.org.
And if you are so inclined, you can buy Michael and I, or both of us, or one of us, whichever way you want to do it, a coffee, and it would be very much appreciated. The details of how to do so are in the end credit sting, so don't turn off early.
Cheers, dudes. See you later. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Hey Kids Comics is a The Devil Will Make Work for Idle Hands to Do production, and hosted by Andrew and Michael Leyland. All opinions expressed in the show are the opinions of the hosts and no one else. The free-to-use music that closes and opens the show was the sci-fi cyberpunk trailer by somebody called Stringer Bell on the Pixabay.com free-to-use website. Thank you very much to them. Every single episode of the show going all the way back to the beginning in 2010 is available on archive.org at the address archive.org/details/@APLUK, where you can fill your boots on over 15 years of classic episodes. If you would like to support the show, you can buy Michael and I, or both of us, or one of us, a coffee. Go to ko-fi.com, that's ko-fi.com/A Leyland. In 1 month, an all-new episode of Hey Kids Comics, coming in your ears. It's a date.